I am Claire Mitchell, Doctor of Laws and King's Counsel.
And I am Zoe Vendetotse, Doctor of Laws, teacher and writer.
On the 8th of March 2020, International Women's Day, we launched the Feminist Witches of Scotland campaign. The Witchcraft Act, enforced between 1563 and 1736, saw thousands of people, mostly women, accused and executed as witches in Scotland, in the country's biggest and most brutal miscarriage of justice. Our campaign had three aims: to get a formal state apology for those accused of witchcraft, to obtain a pardon for all those convicted, and to get a national memorial to remember those involved in the Witchcraft Act.
On International Women's Day 2022, the first of our aims was realised when First Minister Nicola Sturgeon issued a formal state apology to those accused as witches. The first formal state apology ever. We are currently working with politicians to ensure there is legislation passed to pardon those accused as witches, to change their status from convicted witches to those who ought never to have been prosecuted. We continue our work to obtain a national monument so those who suffered will never be forgotten. Join us as we speak to the experts on the witchcraft trials, both here in Scotland and further abroad, as we explore the history of women in Scotland and continue the cultural conversation of what it means to be a woman. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. Claire, what episode is this one?
This is episode 67, Zoe. And those who are like been following us every week might just have noticed that we haven't managed to get this in under the 2 week limit once again.
I'm interpreting time very, very loosely at the moment. So I'm just in the moment, Claire. You know me. I'm just in the moment. And if the moment is you tell me to turn up in front of my computer to record, then I just do it.
Oh, no. See, the thing is that I listen to other podcasts and like when they're not there on the appointed day,
I do. Splitter. Sorry. I gave them up and started recording.
There's no one else to listen to but us. No, I still give my time to the occasional podcast. And like when it's not there, when I think it should be there, I'm quite annoyed.
Yeah. Wow.
Anyway.
It's only you and me. So it's just, you know, it's when a busy single mother of three is trying to get her life back on the tracks and a hard-bitten top lawyer who's doing the, I don't know why I'm doing an American accent for this. When those two women have got time.
Do you think it's kind of like we're the Cagney and Lacey of the podcast world?
Yeah, I love that. But that means that I'm the sort of the downtrodden, dark-haired one.
I thought you were going to be the... because she's the mother.
She's the mother, yeah.
Yeah, but then that would make the alcoholic blonde one.
If the cap fits, Claire.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I'm only joking. I'm not impugning your reputation at all. Not an alcoholic.
Going to
definitely
sue
not you.
You'll be hearing from my solicitor.
I'm your solicitor.
There would definitely be a conflict.
Anywho.
Yeah, let's stop talking about suing you.
Yes, that's a very dangerous path to go down. So, Claire, today we've got a very interesting person on, as usual, a very interesting interviewee. But before that, just wondering, has anything exciting been happening in the world?
News.
We need to work on that tune amongst everything else.
Zoe's got her hands up to her face like Edward Munch's The Scream.
I'm a little bit screamy on that one. But has anything been happening?
Yeah, loads is happening. First of all, as you know, Zoe, we've been invited to another book festival.
Yes, now I'm excited about this because I've never been to this one before, but I've heard much about it. So we were invited to come to or go to Wigton Festival in April, at the end of April. I think maybe the 29th and 30th we're going down there. And that'll be really nice. That'll be good to do. I'm looking forward to that one.
We'll give you a shout out about that. This isn't so much a news thing, but we would just want to give a shout out. A few of our listeners have been sending in, as they have said, pictures of their mugs and T-shirts and hoodies that they've been wearing. And we just want to give a particular shout out to Pauline Kilgour. I think that's how it's pronounced. The reason for that is she has taken our hoodie south of the border down to England. And she says if she hears any stories of witchcraft trials down there, she'll give us a shout out on the way back up. So she sent us a photograph of her proud hoodie on her train on the way down to London, which was great. So we'll post up that very so cool. People can see it.
Very cool. And then also there's somebody from abroad who's been in touch.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that's Beth Marrick from Chicago, the place, not the musical. Claire wrote that down. I had to read that out loud. I like that.
That could have just been the inside voice that did that bit.
In case there was any issue that people thought that we were working closely with musical theatre, just to be clear, we've not written a musical yet, although Claire, maybe we should add that to the things that we're doing. She is from Chicago, America. Okay, and she's got in contact with us to let us know that the BBC are doing a documentary about the Bridget Bishop trial called Cry Innocent.
That's a trial over in Salem. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, good, I really look forward to that. And then I thought, why is the BBC going all the way over to Salem once again to do a TV show about the trials that happened there when we have an incredible scene of witchcraft trials here and could tell the story of some of the women. So thanks to Beth for getting in contact. And it's not to say I won't look forward to it and definitely watch it. I just kind of thought, are you not missing a chance?
Yeah, it's strange. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens on that one. But I'm sure it'll be fascinating anyway. And then we've also had somebody else get in touch with us from abroad.
We have.
To tell us a really interesting story, which I'm going to hand over to you to talk about, Claire.
Yes. So Kelly Spence Towson and her daughter Holly Townsend, Kelly has got in contact with us to tell us something really quite exciting. She is from Ontario, Canada, so another one of our international listeners, and she says that she has traced her father's ancestors back to the 10th great-grandfather born in 1575 in Bursey Parish, Orkney. One of his sons, i.e. the 9th great-grandfather, was John Spence, who was married to Maribel Cooper. Now, that's very interesting for us because Maribel Cooper was accused of witchcraft, and we're going to talk more about her today later. So what happened was that she has been able to trace her lineage right down to herself. And as far as I'm aware, that's the first person that's able to trace direct lineage. We're also being contacted by someone else who says they can do it, and that's Melissa Fox, that we really dearly hope to be able to get in contact with and chat to as well. But one of the things about the records in Orkney is they're really amazing. The archivist in the Orkney Library says that if you're ever going up there, if you just give her a day or so's notice, obviously the better notice, the better, she would be able to get out for you the details of the witchcraft trials if you want to look at them and actually look at the documents. But I remember when I was up there speaking to people about the witchcraft trials, their archive is so full and so detailed. So it appears that somebody has been able to trace their lineage back from John Spence of that time right through 10 generations to now Kelly and her daughter Holly living in Canada. So that's absolutely amazing.
I think a big part of that must be because they emigrated. So the paperwork is so much better because they left Scotland, and then there'll be the sort of the manifest for travelling. And then, you know, in an emigration story, I think there's always much more sort of documentation and people remember things in the same, in a different way to how if you just stay in one country. We've had a few people in Scotland get in touch with us to say they've traced their family back. But having spoken to Scottish archivists, they're not sure whether there really is the documentation for that. And actually, we've got a previous guest who has a contact who's really, really good on this, who's going to come on the show in the future. So we'll do a special how to trace your family back if it's possible episode at some point.
Oh, that would be great.
The problem in Scotland, of course, is that, you know, there are so many names that are so common to Scotland. And we know that names are often written down incorrectly and spelled differently. And you may have like a whole bunch of, for example, one of my mum's side of the family names is Kavanagh. And there are lots of Kavanaghs about, but we're not necessarily all related to each other.
Not Kavanagh KC.
No, we don't talk about that. Where Kavanaugh with a C, I think Kavanaugh case QC was K, I think maybe. But I think also that's something that's changed. The spelling's changed over time too. So I think that people sometimes think, well, my name is, you know, McRae or Campbell, and we think we're roughly from this area in Fife, and there is a Campbell that was accused then. But for my money, you'd have to be really able to absolutely trace it back to prove without a shadow of a doubt that it definitely is. And I'm just not entirely sure the documentation's here. And it's all very well saying, oh, just trace your family tree back. But you can't necessarily do that far back, because just the documentation's so patchy for those that were not rich.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the interesting things in particular, as I see about Orkney, the detail is there. Whoever was recording at that time in Orkney has done a really amazing job. And clearly, as you say, if people then move abroad to other countries, what Kelly says is that she comes from the line, not directly the woman who, Maribel Cooper, who was executed as a witch, but she comes from the line of the second wife that he married.
Right, so I see.
What she says is, had she not been accused and executed as a witch, she would have remained alive. He wouldn't have married again, and I wouldn't be here.
Isn't that funny? What a funny thought.
Yeah. Well, what she said in the messages that I was having with her was, she was very drawn, and she's coming to Orkney in 2024. But she says, every time I think of Maribel Cooper, I get chills when I think that because of her, spoiler, execution and him remarrying, my whole world is what it is. So it's quite
funny.
Yeah, it's quite incredible that we don't really think of the world as a changed landscape because of the executions, but Scotland's whole population could have been so much more if critically 2,000 people at least we hadn't lost that. Because when you're talking about a group of only 900,000 people, 2,000 is quite a lot, particularly if those are women of a childbearing age.
Yeah, for sure. And I was talking to, I gave a talk in schools recently, or give a few talks. And that was one of the things that helped me, the connection for the kids with, you know, what's this got to do with me? And we were talking about surnames and saying, you know, these are old Scottish names. And if you imagine that, and it could be there was somebody that you were related to that was accused or was an accuser. And then we talked about all the people that had been lost and all the potential kind of generations lost. It's a really fascinating, horrible, but fascinating sort of area to think about.
Yeah, well, it certainly hits home very directly to Kelly and Holly. So please do stay in contact with us and let us know your trip to Orkney. And as a result of her getting in contact and talking about Maribel Cooper, I thought that we should say today the person that we should remember is Maribel Cooper. And I've looked up what information I can on her. So Maribel Cooper was from Bursey in the Presbytery of Cairnston, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, on Orkney. It said she resided in Northside and she was married to John Spens. And John Spens is the relative of Kelly that we just mentioned. The case, which was the serious one which she was convicted of, was in 1624. But in fact, that was the second allegation. She'd been tried previously and banished, but she refused to leave. And what happened was, it appeared, she says, I'm going to voluntarily leave if you drop the charges. And having made that deal, she then failed to go. So at some point later, another accusation arises. She was accused in 1624 and her trial took place on the 7th of July of that year. She was accused of maleficium, doing bad things, using the power of the devil, and it was said that she was involved in neighbourhood disputes. It's recorded, and of course all this information, as usual, comes from the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft. She was recorded as carrying out rituals and accused, as were many people, of taking the profits off of someone's cow. Now, I'm not quite sure how that worked. Did she stop that cow producing milk, or then did that cow stop producing milk and her produced twice as much? I'm not sure how that worked. But anyway, it was said that she carried out these rituals, taking the profit of someone's cow. And she was also found to be a woman who got into fights, cursing and quarrelling about cattle. She had a dispute with a neighbour over a borrowed kiln, which was used to grind corn. She was also accused of flighting. Now, I have to say, when I read that, Zoe, I thought flighting is probably just an old word for flying. But
no, we've definitely heard that one before, haven't we?
Yeah, I looked it up on the Dictionary of Scottish Language, DSL, and it tells us that flighting is, quote, the action of quarrelling or scolding or employing abusive language. So I think fair to say she was a quarrelsome dame.
Who amongst us has not flighted?
Absolutely. Who amongst us doesn't flight every day of the week?
Some of us get paid for flighting.
So she was also said to have made sarcastic comments about the devil, and people referred to her as a banished witch, which is fair enough because she was supposed to be banished after she was accused of witchcraft last time. The Survey of Scottish Witchcraft can give us quite a lot of information about her. And this is a really weird one, Zoe. She had a great bag like a fawn's bladder, and the translation is a great bag like a fawn's bladder, on her lap, which she claimed was her own guts, which a woman had trampled out with her knees. Ladies and gentlemen.
That's horrible.
Yeah, for the purpose of the podcast, Zoe's face is squished up in great distaste.
There's just a lot in that description.
Absolutely. So basically she was feigning that her own guts were hanging out and sitting in her lap, but it was thought to be a fawn's bladder. And was she referring to some shamanistic removal of organs? Now, that is the idea of the person who's read this. We just don't really know, we don't really understand it. She seemed to imply that she was being bewitched and trying to find the witch who was plaguing her, her husband, and her household. Some tried to appease the person she believed to be the culprit with ale. So it was one of these sorts of, I suppose, cross allegations that she was saying, I'm not the witch, I'm trying to find the witch who's put a curse on me. And then ended up being accused herself. She was also charged with the crimes of sorcery and superstition. Now, don't ask me the difference from sorcery and witchcraft. I just don't know, and it's not in the Act. Maybe those are common law offences, I'm not sure. So she was charged with those offences as well. Alas, as I've already said, she was convicted after trial, and the record shows that she was taken to the execution by the Lochman, and she was executed at Gallows Ha. That's the hill at the top of the village in Orkney, right where the memorial is placed. Remember, they were just for the memorial. And that's where that was. So she was executed at that space. So that was Maribel Cooper from Orkney, a woman, not a witch.
Okay, so that's a really fascinating one to look at today, and very serendipitous that we were contacted. That's really interesting. It's nice to make that connection between real people and the stories. You know, that's really interesting.
Absolutely.
We have been asked a couple of times recently by people what the status is of the pardon just now and of a potential memorial. So should we just highlight what that is just now?
Oh, sure. Well, what I can say is this, the public comments in respect of the private members bill have closed. So all those have been collated, but they're not being put out at the moment. Now, I suspect that might be because there are other things going on at the moment and there isn't any immediate necessity for this to be placed before Parliament or raised. But we really hope very soon that that's going to be made public. If and when it's made public, we will then approach various people that we've already talked to get cross-party support for putting this forward. I suspect, but I don't know, that it will be held back until the new parliamentary session that it's now dealt with. But we will keep you informed of that. In relation to the National Memorial, we've had a lot of discussions, not only behind the scenes with bodies that are interested in being involved, but also other groups, Zoe.
We have, yeah. So we've been in touch with various different community groups that are doing wonderful things in their own communities, who we've talked to on the podcast, and we've mentioned lots of times in the podcast. We feel very, very strongly that as our campaign has always been, it's the witches of Scotland, it's right across Scotland. And we think that as the popularity has grown of the campaign, and as we've grown with listeners, and people have been so wonderful and been in touch and have worked with us and then have started their own projects and they've made friends with other people doing the projects, that it has to absolutely be a collegiate community endeavour. So we certainly have nothing to do with some recent mooted plans by one group. We don't work with them, and we are very keen on working with community groups right across Scotland. So certainly we'll keep doing that. We have had a really interesting idea that hopefully we'll be able to kind of see through and then tell you about, but we have to do a little bit of work on that first.
Don't tease us.
Well, do you know what it is? Are you remembering?
No.
Look in your file facts.
I'm going to look in the file facts.
We have had something that Claire and I came up with that I think is a really interesting
proposal. I remember.
Good. I'm glad you do, Claire. So we will be following that up. And as soon as we've got that kind of like moving along, we'll be in touch, because that's something that will require different community buy-ins. So we'll be back in touch when we've got that one sorted out and let you know what that is. I think it's also worth mentioning that International Women's Day was a couple of weeks ago. By the time this comes out, I suppose it'll be around about that. And we gave a talk as part of the Leverhulme Institute at University of Dundee, because of course they very generously and wonderfully gave us our honorary doctorate. So now we have this lovely working relationship with them. And we're very, very happy to go and speak to Professor Niamh McDade, who is fascinating, such an interesting academic, and the work she does is really amazing. So we went and spoke to her about that. We had a lovely crowd, and it was a really nice event to do. However, it wasn't streamed or recorded, and we had lots of people get in touch with us afterwards saying, oh, we'd really like for you to do that. And we thought, well, maybe it's time for us to put together a little online event again where we'll get different speakers. So we're just putting that together just now, and we'll let you know we've got a date for that one, just like we did last year. And also, as it was International Women's Day, worth mentioning, I think, again, that that's been then a year since we secured the apology from the First Minister for those accused of witchcraft. So I think, you know, it's good to remember these things because we're all working together. So the apology is secured, the pardon is underway, and the memorial is still very much in our sights, and we're working away on it with all our partners in the community across Scotland.
Yeah. Just to be clear, though, we're not actually physically building it ourselves, are we, Zoe?
Well, I don't know. It'll depend. We'll see.
Zoe's getting on her dungarees and travel.
Well, I've got one child studying sculpture, and I've got another one that starts studying sculpture in September. So I reckon by the time we get the funding in place, I'll have two that could at least build things. So who knows?
That's not a bad idea. Folks,
I think it's something that we just, you know, it's difficult because there's so many things that are going on and there's so much happening in the news and politics is so febrile at the moment. I think it's good to remember where we've come from and where we're going. So I think Absolutely. We just mentioned it again to people. Yeah.
So, okay. Zoe, tell us, who are we going to be speaking to today? Oh, I love it that we always build up the tension of who we're going to be speaking to, but before people actually click on the podcast, we like give them the name and also the details.
I know, but it's quite nice because it reminds me of Stars in Their Eyes. It's a bit like that.
Tonight, so I quite Matthew.
Like, yeah, Tonight, Matthew. David might end up cutting this out, but I was out with my single friend at the weekend, and these two quite elderly rugby supporters who had done really kind of mad sort of tartan Stetsons in a bar that we were in Edinburgh came up to us and said, girls, we're not girls, we're in our mid to late 40s, said, I just want you to know you're absolutely gorgeous, and if I was 20 years younger, I'd be in about you. And then he walked towards the door of the bar and he turned back and he sang in the bar and he just said to us, but tonight, Matthew, I am not, and then left. It was very hilarious. And only people of a certain age that used to watch Stars in Their Eyes will have got that joke. But I thought it was hilarious.
Absolutely.
That was probably the best line of the night, to be honest. But anyway.
It was very nice. He sounds like a right laugh.
He did. I think 20 years is a bit generous. But anyway. So we have today a fantastic guest who we've wanted to get on for a while. He's dead interesting on Twitter. He's doing a really interesting project that is absolutely really, really worth going and having a look at. We often have people ask us about where in the world he's from and his area of specialisation. And we've only done one show before that touched on it, and that was somebody that he's worked with actually in the past. But he will tell you all about it in the forthcoming interview that you're about to hear. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce today's guest, Dr. Andrew Sneddon, who's a social and cultural historian with a special interest in Britain and Ireland viewed in an international context, and has written loads of really, really interesting stuff. And he's looking at the framework from the medieval to the modern period. He wrote a book called Witchcraft and Magic in Ireland, and another one called Representing Magic in Modern Ireland, Belief, History and Culture. Then he's written tons of really fascinating stuff, like really interesting. There's too many to actually list here, but definitely worth going and having a wee noodle around and seeing what you can find of Dr. Andrew Sneddon's work. I'm delighted today to say that we have finally managed to get on our guest, because the last time we arranged to speak to our guest, Claire locked herself out of the house. So unfortunately, it wasn't able to go ahead because she was wandering around her village looking for her keys, which she dropped on her dog walk.
I'm delighted
that our guest is actually sort of born with us and agreed to come on a second time. And I've been nervous all day that some other catastrophe would occur. But it's okay. I think we're all here. We're all present and correct. So without any further chat from me, I'd like to welcome to today's episode, Dr. Andrew Sneddon. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. How's it going?
Good, thank you. Good. So we basically, I think first, the most important thing is, why don't you tell our listeners why it is that we've invited you onto the podcast?
Well, I don't know, actually, but I suppose...
That sounded like it was... Actually, that was a bit like you were going to go, well, I don't know, I've caught up with such. Is this like, this is my life with Cilla Black? What is your area of study, Dr. Andrew Smith? It would be of interest to the Witches of Scotland listeners.
Well, I have been researching history of magic and witchcraft for, you know, I thought about it the other day, and it's 24 years. I started off writing the biography in my PhD of Bishop Francis Hutcheson, who was a witchcraft skeptic who was writing against, in the early 18th century, witch hunting in England. It had finished, but he wanted to continue on with that there. And then I moved on, and from probably the late 2000s, I was starting to look at Irish witchcraft, because my students were saying, you know, I'm at Ulster University, and my students were saying, well, what about Ireland? And I'm saying, well, I don't know, because nobody's written on it, really. Some people had, but it was a few articles and things, you know, not any great studies. So that's what I started to do.
Our understanding is we had the guest on from Ireland quite a long time ago. And at the time, the guest told us that they were making a TV documentary about witches in Ireland, that there was a huge difference between what happened in Scotland and what happened in Ireland at the same time. And the reason that she gave at that time was that Ireland had more of an appreciation and understanding of magic, and it was more culturally acceptable, and that obviously religion was quite different there to what it was at that point in Scotland. Is that the reason why? Is that what you would say? Or
I was the historical consultant on that programme, and most of what she was saying would be based on my research, to be honest.
Okay.
So
it's a very small witchcraft world once you get into it.
I know, especially the people on that show, you know, Lizanne Henderson and all that was on there, and Julian Goodair, and
the witch gang.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it depends what you're looking at, but I would say specifically the mass of the population, the Gaelic Irish, Irish speaking, believed in, you know, people who harmed using magic, but they didn't go to the Protestant courts, or largely because they didn't think the threat was as great, because their witches only attacked produce at specific times of the year, like butter and milk, you know. So they weren't as much of a threat in that community. And others have argued that even if they wouldn't have used colonial Protestant courts, you know.
Well, hang on, can I just go back to what you've just said a second ago? There you go. So witches just attacked particular produce, and it was particularly like butter and milk, just like an anti-dairy, like lactose intolerant witch.
Yeah, well, so basically they would see them, you know, the kind of folkloric witch that continued on, but it actually caused, and that was my later research, caused loads of court cases in the 19th century where you would transfer the productiveness, and you'll see this in all parts of Celtic Britain as well, you'll see it in Scandinavia, where they would transfer the productiveness from somebody else's milk to your own. So basically, no matter how much you turn your milk and try to get butter, it won't work because somebody else has stole it. So you've got 30 cows that are producing no butter, and you've got one, and they take it really seriously, you know, especially in the 19th century when this product is worth more, you know, to life and limb. But in the early modern period, you know, it's not as much, but still enough to cause arguments. But, you know, usually they use magic to counter it or work it out in their own communities.
How interesting.
The Protestants are different from Scotland.
Is it because Ireland at that time had a much smaller Protestant population as well that it didn't take hold?
Yeah, I mean, if they're coming, right? It depends when you look at it, at patterns of migration, you know. So you will get witch trials in, you know, big settler towns and areas like Yeo in Cork in 1661. And it's very much English-type witchcraft because you will see the familiar. You'll talk about swimming the witch. So you'll see the kind of things that are associated with English witchcraft because they're the English in Ireland now.
What's swimming the witch, just before we move on? What's that?
All right, swimming the witch or the ordeal or the water ordeal is where, you know, if sink or swim, basically.
Oh, that's duking them. Okay.
Yeah, basically, if, you know... The water expels them, they're evil, and it's a test of witchcraft. And they actually mention that in the Yeo trial. They don't actually do it. They threaten to do it, but you don't see that when you come to County Antrim in 1711 because it's Scottish people, you know, and it's not as much in their culture, you know. So they start coming over, you know, in the 17th century, and especially after... yeah, I'd say about 1650, 1660 in large numbers, and concentrate in Antrim and Down and Derry and places like that. And that is where you get the, you know, the witchcraft accusations among these Presbyterian Scots. They're bringing it with them.
So we've found out, because we were talking to someone about the Witches of Vardo quite recently, and we were like, so how did this all start? And she was like, it was a Scotsman that arrived. We were like, oh dear, sorry about that.
I mean, you don't hear that on the big list of all the things the Scots achieved, do you? You know, they invented this, they invented that, they spread the horror of witch trials around the world. It's like not so much mentioned on the tea towels. But it's quite marked, the difference, really, isn't it? Were you surprised by that the more you looked into it in the early days of your research?
Well, to be honest, when I found Ellen McGee Witches away backwards, you know, and I just couldn't believe my luck, really, you know, because I try all like this, maybe not in Scotland, because it's only... Now I think Scotland is coming into its own and realising how big it was, you know. But when I looked at Ireland, I couldn't believe that nobody had really did a book on this.
Can you tell us the story of Ellen McGee then?
Yeah, that's what we'd like to hear.
Yeah, okay. The Ellen McGee, how do you start? It was something, I'm writing the second, as we speak, I was doing it today, I'm writing the second edition of Possessed by the Devil, my book on the Ellen McGee Witches, you know, and succinctly in 1710, an old woman, Anne Hartridge, who is a Presbyterian minister's wife, she starts to basically be haunted by a demon, and you see everything that's associated with, well, today people would call it poltergeist activity, then it would be demonic obsession, just before demonic possession, when a demon attacks the body and maybe the mind. So all that's happening, and that happens for a few months, and you know, she sees a wee demonic boy and all that, and they smashes windows, and you get lithobolia as well, stone thrown. And then it disappears, and it comes back in February, and then, you know, it's... She's sieging death. It's making the bedclothes up in the shape of a corpse, for example. And she dies suddenly with stabbing pains in her back. Now, because of the demonic boy and everything else, people are putting two and two together and are saying, right, this is probably witchcraft. But like some cases, they don't know who. And so six days after old Anne died, Mary Dunbar, who is a cousin, you know, or a niece, actually, of old Mrs. Hartridge had died. She comes, you know, to keep the family company, because James Hartridge, who's Anne Hartridge's son, he's away in Dublin, and she's keeping the family company. She picks up this, a poppet, basically, you know, it's It's the old woman's missing bonnet wrapped in an apron. She's told not to touch it. She unwraps it, becomes demonically possessed. You know, just basically, you know, I'm not going through the... Watch The Exorcist, because that is a good early modern portrayal. It's not a, like a 20th century portrayal of demonic possession. It's a good early modern one. All those symptoms, and she doesn't blame herself. She doesn't say, this is sin, and the devil is basically tempting me or punishing me. She says it's witches. And she does exactly like you would see in Paisley in 1697, you know, Pitt and Weem. You know, it's very, very similar to these cases. It's a witchcraft case by demonic possession. So she sees these people attacking her in spectral form. And with that, because she says she's a stranger to the place, she is able to, you know, describe their clothes, describe their, you know, the way they look, and track them down. And the women that she basically accuses are all poor. They're all Presbyterian. They've got dubious reputations, and some of them are disabled. And they're tracked down, and they're basically tried under the 1586 Irish Witchcraft Act. They try to bring in old Mrs. Haltridge's death. If that would have been upheld by the other judge, they would have been all executed. But that is put to one side. The trial goes ahead. They all plead not guilty. They're all found not guilty. And they have to spend a year in jail and four times in the pillory. Mary Dunbar doesn't get better. So what she actually does is accuse the husband of one of the convicted witches and the father of one of the convicted witches. So you've got a witch family here. And as far as I can tell, Mary Dunbar dies 3 weeks after the trial. So it becomes a capital case. And by inference, just like you do in a lot of Scottish cases, he would have been executed for, you know, bewitching Mary Dunbar to death. So that's the Elmgee witches. Sorry, I wasn't as...
Well, that's a good description. So does the graphic novel that's coming out, does that tell that story then?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I was working with Dr. Victoria McCollum, and she's in cinematic arts, and a graphic artist, David Campbell. And we were very much sticking to the story, because what we wanted somebody to pick this up, right, and go, right, we know that's what happened, you know. So we have changed some events, you know, and condensed things, because it's a graphic novel and it has to be, you know, but we list everything that's changed at the end and stuff, you know, and we haven't changed much. Everything, all the people and all the events that are portrayed, you know, are based on the events that happened. And if anybody wants to read it, we've got a website, w711.org, and I've digitized all the documents, and they're all up there, and you can freely download them, you know.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's
I've been giving talks in the high school that I work at recently to the second years who are doing a unit in history on the witch trials in Scotland. And I think anything like that is so grabby, and it just makes so much more sense to people generally, but particularly to young people, if they can see that there's a visual that goes with it. That's fantastic.
And we're giving it, see, the graphic novel, I mean, you can buy a fancy copy, but what we're doing is after it's launched, you hit a button and you ask us for a copy if you want to use it in education or...
Oh, whatever. Fabulous.
It'll be a PDF copy, but you can, you know, the pupils can use it there, and they can could probably, you know, look at the original documents as well with it, you know.
That's so amazing. We'll put a link on when we put the podcast episode out. We'll put links on and we'll tweet them as well.
We're also doing a virtual reality app, you know.
Oh, wow.
And that, well, we're trying to get people to experience what it's like to be accused of witchcraft, but also, and this is, you know, the thing, and you come across it as well, the people who were accusing people of witchcraft really believed it.
Yeah.
Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they were just trying to get rid of people, but they believed it, and we're trying to, you know, show what it was like to live in a mental world where this is a reality and what it was like to be. So that's what it's based on, you know. And we've also got a 9-part kind of animation, you know, probably about 25 minutes long, coming out as well. That'll be incorporated into the VR, but also we'll be releasing that.
Fantastic.
An exhibition. But there's an exhibition on Éireann Gaoithe, which is going to be in Carrickfergus Museum, because the witches were actually, witches, the women and men, were actually tried in Carrickfergus Assizes and found guilty there. And that's where they would have been pilloried. And W.B. Yeats says that one of them lost an eye. He was taking it from a local historian, you know, verbatim, but he was saying that one of them lost an eye. That was the local folklore. And which has really been pelted, which is really, it becomes worse when you think about two of them only had one eye. So that, you know, they could have become completely blind, you know, and I wonder where that came, you know. But the women who were accused, you know, were believable witches.
Yeah, because were they kind of like what we would now think of as being marginalised? Were they kind of outsiders?
Absolutely.
And yeah.
Absolutely. You're poor, yeah. And one of them is said to be an ill-fame. I don't know whether that's sex work, you know, whether you could say that, but
yeah.
Others were saying, you know, given to vaunts and of their own power, you know, and I think what they were saying there is maybe that they were, you know, they would curse people, you know, which you've seen so many other times. Powerless, and one of them, you know, fell in a fire, and so her hand was in a crook and she was burnt on one side. Others were marked with smallpox, you know, and, you know, having sunken eyes, and one, you know, to use the parlance at the time, had a club foot, you know. And yeah. We know that disability, you know, was interpreted in religious terms, you know, so this was almost a kind of, you're reading the body as a text, it's a kind of reflection of inner sin, you know.
Yeah.
So the fact that the word is it would work, you know, when you're thinking of a believable witch and a kind of bad woman as well. You know, so they resist, and I'm really proud of them for this, they resist, they've got no capital at all, social, educational, anything, but they resist every part of the process, you know. They refuse to go and get tested before Mary Dunbar. Their husbands, well, one of them, Andrew Ferguson, tries to intervene in the process. The fact that they're not pliant doesn't help their case either. And William Seller, the man, the husband of Elizabeth Seller, he tries to abscond as well, you know, and he actually uses a drinking horn and hits somebody over the head to try to arrest them as well.
So, I mean, who wouldn't in those circumstances be for the off as soon as you were
absolutely
accused?
Yeah.
But actually, we've not heard that many stories where people fought back. Often the way that the narrative is spun in Scotland is that people kind of mutely accepted it because the machine was so big and, you know, that was the whole community was against you. So it's not often, I mean, obviously because the records are very poor, maybe there were lots of cases where people fought back or whatever, but it tends to be the narrative. It's almost as if they kind of mutely walked away with them, you know, and...
Yeah. I mean, you'll get that a lot in English cases, and you'll get it in Europe as well, where, you know, the family unit, you know, the family unit can work against you. You know, we know in Lancaster, it was, you know, a 9-year-old who got, you know, family members executed. But, you know, sometimes the family unit, especially the husband, you know, fought against it for them, you know. I mean, they didn't often go easier. But to be honest, we are dealing with, and this is where it's weird, we are dealing with perhaps Scottish people, Scottish beliefs in an English system, because the legal system by about 1600 is replacing Breton law and things, right? So it's actually the assize courts. So it's more like the legal system they're working under, justice of the peace, assize courts, is more accusatorial, and it's more like England rather than Scotland. And in fact, even by this period, unlike Scotland, you know, well, maybe Scotland by 1711, but Scotland before then, the clergy would have been up to their necks in it, you know, up to their necks in the prosecution process, whereas you actually see the Presbyterian clergy in Ulster trying to work it out before it goes to court, arbitrating, trying to get them to make up, you know, and then later on what they're doing is, and they do this in Scotland as well, is try to get the people who are accusing each other, you know, or accusing people of witchcraft, done for slander, basically, to dissuade others, you know. So I think by this point, the justice system's different, but it's also probably a wee bit sceptical, just like anywhere else, you know.
You get the impression, don't you, around about that time, certainly from stories that we hear, you get the impression that the church is kind of going, might just not be so fire and brimstone, maybe just back away from that a wee bit and pretend it didn't happen. We heard stories, for example, of a minister asking for all his paperwork to be kept with him when he was firing brimstone 50 years earlier and finding witches everywhere. And then as the world changed, he was wanting to keep all his documents. And the historian said to us that he kind of suspected that he was just trying to keep his vociferous beliefs about witchcraft at the time just a bit quieter, because he realised that that had fallen out with favour and people had moved on from witchcraft.
Well, absolutely. In the 18th and 19th century, that's my latest book, Representing Magic and Ireland. And what that looks is how do people culturally interpret and represent historic witch trials like Iolo and that and the years that passed. And you will see that in the 18th century, just like everywhere else in the 19th century, backing away from it, saying, oh, this was the bigotry of earlier ages. We want nothing to do with that. We're much more enlightened now, and that's got nothing to do. And then in Ireland, obviously, and you know, just by the late 19th century, it becomes politicized and once more. And you know, this is what I argue as well. You know, you'll see the.
And what was the politicisation? What was that? What happened in the 19th century?
You'll get in the kind of 18th and 19th century, you'll get both unionists and nationalists, Catholics and Protestants, both saying, you know, oh, we didn't have much witchcraft. You know, we're backing away from witchcraft, but Ireland was even better because we didn't have many trials. We had, you know, so we're great. And they're both sides are doing that. And they're kind of backing away. But by the crisis of the late 19th century and early 20th century, the nationalists are saying, oh, you know, this is a cultural pollutant. We didn't have witchcraft. We didn't believe in witches. It's a cultural pollutant that was brought by settlers. It's an imperial, you know, import. And you get the unionists who don't want to mention Éireann Magee or anything, because to do so, they're admitting it did actually, you know, in some part come from Britain. And so if you're aligning yourself more with the you know, the British state, then you don't want to do that either, you know. And it's also really gendered. They forget William Seller, because it doesn't fit the narrative of these women were kind of pious, nice, gentle women, you know, who we should feel sorry for because they were like that. We shouldn't feel sorry for them because of the way they were. But, you know, and he doesn't fit that narrative, so he's thrown out in it, both the history books and, you know, in newspapers and in plays, you know.
Well, we're glad that you're setting history right and bringing him back into the picture, because every single person that suffered a witchcraft accusation deserves to be remembered. And we're totally glad that you are bringing that back. See, when you talk about people rewriting, I suppose what you're talking about is people rewriting history for their own purposes and just forgetting the bits that they didn't want. Apart from this particular witchcraft trial, were there any other big instances of witchcraft accusations, or is that really it that we know of? What I'm wondering is there a whole number of other stories out there we haven't heard yet?
Right, well, I mean, the big ones in Yeovil in 1661, you know, and again, I think you go on my webpage for the university, I've transcribed, you know, the court documents if anybody wants them, you know. They're also published, but you can get an early draft of it. And that's another demonic possession witchcraft case, you know, and it's happening in a settler. And again, it's Mary Longdon who accuses, you know, an older woman, Florence Newton, of bewitching her, you know, using demonic possession. And then she goes into jail and the jailer dies. And her method of bewitching is touching. And he, you know, he dies. And kissing people as well. Mary McAuliffe has argued that, you know, one of the reasons why that it was taken so forward because it was the unregulated female touch, you know, this is women kissing women. And maybe, you know, that's why, you know, it was taken so serious. But she uses cursing as well, and she uses other forms. She uses image magic as well. And we don't know really what
magic happened. Sorry, what's image magic, Andrew?
Oh, sorry. You'll get it. Well, I mean, I suppose a voodoo doll is image magic. You know, it uses sympathetic magic. you do something to the object or whatever that's linked to the person. And, you know, in Salem, you know, it would be the rag dolls, the puppets. And in England, you would get wax figures that were melted or stuck with things, you know. It's more rags in this case as well, you know. So there's a whole, you know, a whole load of, you know, things that's going on there. And we assume that she was found guilty and we assume that it was executed, but we don't really know, because it's a bit like the Scottish cases, you know, where you've got the records that tell you about the trial, that, you know, it looks as if, you know, that they're getting found guilty, but there's no other proof apart from that.
You've written, I've counted, you've got Possessed by the Devil, you've got Representing Magic in Modern Ireland, you've got Whigs and Witches, you've got Witchcraft and Magic in Ireland, another one, and then you've got Historical Studies by yourself, and all these are available on Amazon. If somebody is listening, because I know of a lot of our listeners like reading your stuff, and I'm sure they'll want to come and see your webpage. If somebody is coming to the issue of Witches in Ireland for the first time, what book should they start with?
I think they should start with a cheap one, right?
Well, I'm sure they'll
because we get complaints from listeners all the time that we cost them a fortune in books.
Right. Well, so, you know, you can get, I think, Possessed by the Devil, right? As I said, the kind of second edition's coming out, which I'm just going to, basically, I wrote that in 2013. And I said a wee bit of yo, but I expanded on it, you know, and wrote about what happened afterwards, you know. So I'm going to put that into the second edition. But I think the first edition, Possessed by the Devil, gives a good overview. It's written as a narrative, but it is scholarly in that sense as well, you know. So I think you get a good all-rounder. And as far as I can see, it was about £6 on a Kindle.
Very, very good value, Andrew. Very good value indeed.
It's been a totally fascinating speaking to you, Andrew, and it's really interesting to think about how close geographically Ireland was to Scotland. I know it's obviously not like now, but we tend to think of ourselves as being a pretty similar sort of a people. So it's interesting to see the contrast between the two areas, or really three, I suppose, if we think about England as well, with the English people that came across and what was happening there. So it's really fascinating to think of it in those terms. And I'm really interested to see what your graphic novel's like as well, and see the way that you've presented it there. Because I think at the end of the day, what we all want is for people to understand history and to have like an accurate understanding of history, not the history that people have said where, oh no, we had nothing to do with that, that was nothing to do with us, and, you know, sort of allied the things that actually happened. So I think it'll be really fascinating. So thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. It was really nice talking to you, and I think that your whole campaign and the website and everything is great. And
oh, thanks.
That's really nice to hear. Oh, good, good. And it's good we're all working together. That's what I really love about this campaign, is that every time we speak to another fantastic expert, it's nice. We're sharing that knowledge. And as a teacher, I'm a big fan of we share, you know, and it's nice because it means there's people that have stumbled upon the issue that didn't really have an interest before, that have now jumped off in loads of different directions. And I know when your episode goes out, we'll have people getting in touch with us saying, oh, my family were from Ireland originally, so how can I find out about whether my family was involved in that there? Which I think is brilliant. Anything that sparks curiosity is a good thing. Absolutely. In my book.
Thanks very, very much for your time. We really appreciate it. And folks, for those that you can't see, Andrew not only has written a lot of books, but has a very, very impressive bookshelf behind him. And
it's very messy at all, because I'm actually using it at the minute.
That's good. See, when you see people that have got these bookshelves that are colour coordinated, you just think, what's going on there?
Or worse, when you see those things where they've got the books turned around the other way, so it's uniformly sort of like the buff coloured pages.
Oh, no. That's
oh, it was getting absolute fear. How the hell can you find anything?
Exactly. Well, you don't use them, obviously, you know.
So they're just purely for show.
Now, Andrew, can we just finally get from you, if we do come across to Ireland, will you meet us for a coffee if we're going to go about?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. That's us. We've got an invite to Ireland. That works. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. We really enjoyed it.
See you later.
Bye.
Well, thanks so much for listening to another episode, and only the 67th episode of 6 from Witches of Scotland. As ever, please, please do get in touch with us on our different social media platforms. We're most active on Twitter, although we also use Instagram, and we've got our Facebook page where we share information, which is really a cool place to share stuff from different people that are working in Scotland and further afield. And remember that we've got merch, and the money from the merch does not go to us. It goes towards David, who is still manfully battling on trying to shape the drivel that Claire and I put together into an acceptable audio format. Thank you so much, David. And also, I think we also have the facility where you can buy David a coffee. So that's there too. But please do get in touch with us. We're always fascinated to hear what you're doing in your own communities, or if you've got any personal links to any of the stories.
Yeah. So we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks' time.
2 weeks' time. I mean, what's a week or two either side of that between friends?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. We'll try our best. We always do try our best.
That's we do.
One thing. We're triers. As my dad used to say, very trying, but we are triers. So, okay. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.